So originally in the program, it said I would be using 2 years, but the ASTO profile changed their occupational categorizations a little bit. So I choose to use the most recent version. So we're just looking at the relationship and workforce for state health agencies and certain health outcomes for the year of 2010. And I'd like to acknowledge my coworkers, Rick Ingram and Christina Roberson, which are hiding from me today because they're afraid they'll get more work. I have no relationships to disclose at this time. And this data was obtained from the 2010 ASTO Profile Survey, which is a project supported by a cooperative agreement between ASTO and CDC, as well as Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Health outcomes data was obtained from America's Health Rankings, which is a partnership between United Health Foundation, APHA, and Partnership for Prevention to collect information on the health of the nation. And also included information from the Census Bureau. This is my dissertation, so this is a work in progress, and this is only a small part, so your feedback today will be greatly appreciated. So I have three overarching questions in looking at the relationship between workforce and health outcomes. And the main one I'm going to be talking about today is what is the relationship between the number of full-time equivalents per population for state public health agencies and state health outcomes. But in the future, I'll be looking at that relationship and select services provided. So within ASTO, it asks you whether or not the state leads it, the local leads it, nonprofit, for-profit, et cetera, and health outcomes. And then finally, I'm going to be looking at if there's an association between state-level health outcomes and direct patient care full-time equivalents. If that's different, then the association between state-level health outcomes and population-based full-time equivalents. What Katie Sellers was really concerned about at ASTO was in particular in states in the South where there's more of a clinical focus for the state. There's also worse health outcomes. So she was worried that because there's more employees as well in the southern states, this would suggest that more employees would lead to worse health outcomes, which I don't want to promote at all. And this is really my framework for this entire project. Since I don't have a complete set of performance measures for all states that's really contemporaneous, since the National Performance Standards, I think, only had about 22 for the entire state, I chose to look at inputs of workforce, funding, governance, the actual structure of a state, whether or not it's centralized, decentralized, the services they're providing, and ultimately to see if this leads to improved outcomes. And a little bit about the history of ASTO. It's made up of the 50 states, 8 territories, and D.C. And in the ASTO 2010, only 2 territories responded. For the purpose of this study, I'm just using the 50 states. And what was a little bit frustrating about looking at the workforce data is not everybody completed each question. So for some of them, all 50 states completed, and then others about half. A little bit of history about the ASTO data. So this is something I've been bothering Ron Bialik about, and we're not sure where this data is. It's on some giant old floppy drive. And ASTO had a reporting system for about 25 years. And it's sitting on floppy drive, and it mostly looked at expenditures. But this could be a proxy for collecting information about workforce. But it broke down expenditures into maternal and child health, oral health, and different things. In 2001 and 2007, I believe Les Veitch was involved in in 2005, looking at the state health officials' salary and infrastructure survey. And in 2007, ASTO formally began their profile survey, and they completed this again in 2010. However, for their 2007, their workforce survey was separate from their main profile. And there's a new PHSSR research agenda that's being vetted right now, but really my framework from this project was from what Carol Crawford and her colleagues did. And this was focused only on public health workforce. And so this project is really looking at, does public health workforce have an impact on health, and what the demand is for public health workforce? Because ultimately, we hope that we're improving health. Now, no one has really looked at workforce and health outcomes. Paul Irwin in 2010 looked at this with his finance data of NACHO and America's Health Rankings, and he found that with increased numbers of full-time equivalents, there's decreased numbers of infectious disease. And more recently, Glenn Mays looked at finance expenditures and different diseases, and he found the same results as Paul Irwin. And additionally, infectious disease and cardiovascular disease were decreased with greater funding to public health. So this is potentially something we could take to policymakers as reasons why we should have more money and more people in the field. And so a little bit about how many people are working. From the ASTO survey, there's over 100,007, I believe, full-time equivalent workers. And the average population size is about 6 million. Now, ASTO categorizes their states into small, medium, and large. So those states with about 6 million or more are considered large states. Also looked at full-time equivalents per population, part-time, and contract. And as Maureen and others have stated before, public health nurses and environmentalists are in deficit, but they're still making up the greatest percentage of our workforce, as well as health administrators. There's not too many preparedness directors. And I didn't include the number that responded to each question, but public health dentists in only about 23 states responded, so this may not reflect the true numbers across the state. I did a basic Pearson's correlation, looking to see the relationship, and this just suggests that there's a relationship, but I haven't controlled for the other variables, so don't be worried at this point, because I'm not satisfied with suggesting that the more workers we have, the worse infectious disease. But this is just showing that there is a relationship between infectious disease and full-time equivalents, and the same for full-time equivalents and population for air pollution and occupational fatalities. And I'm sorry, I should have prefaced this. The numbers in red are significant, as well as the numbers in green. And the numbers in yellow are approaching significance, so I'll probably include these in my final model. But all these have a positive correlation with the disease, so I have some feeling that maybe there, because there's more workers, maybe these things are getting better reported. But it's approaching significance for teen birth and geographic disparity, which is just a measure of whether or not there's a difference between the counties within each state. And also premature deaths was approaching significance for full-time employees per population. So some other things I'm going to control for are the state health department structure and the new governance characteristics categorized by Michael Met through NORC, what the role of the state health agencies are, whether or not your state has a board of health, and not many do, what they can actually do as far as powers, their expenditures, the qualifications and the provision of service delivery, as well as basic demographic characteristics on the census, such as the age and poverty level. There does appear to be a relationship between full-time equivalencies and full-time equivalencies per population and health outcomes. But until I do these other analyses, I'm not comfortable in saying that definitively there is a relationship without controlling for these other things. And here's my contact information.
That was so great. Thank you so much.
The floor is now open for questions. Go ahead, Emma.
I have a question for Robin. How do you talk a little bit about how you're going to talk about the provision of services with related to the clinical? In the beginning, you talked about clinical and sal and all that. How are you going to go about that?
So when you look at the ASTO questionnaire, it's really nice because they've broken out what they consider clinical services and population-based services. And then it splits the question into who is leading it and who's providing. So I'm just going to grab that. And then within America's Health Rankings, they also categorize different health outcomes, whether they consider it clinical or more population-based. And I didn't include that on this slide, but it'll be much more in-depth than it is right now.
Go ahead, sir.
Follow-up question. Would it be more helpful to the consumers of your study if you had two points in time to analyze, one maybe 10 years ago, and then one more current, or at least pick a time when public health departments, local and state, were more fully funded and fully staffed as a baseline, and then look at, you know, 2010 or whatever,
this comparison, just like what? I would definitely like to do that, and for my dissertation, so I get out sometime in the next couple months, I'm just going to use 2010. But then, I'm talking about using workforce as something I can do my entire career on, and so I would like to use all the same variables for NACHO and link it up with the county level, and they've done that a lot longer for workforce, and it would be really nice if ASTO would capture some of that information a lot earlier, but their past one on workforce was 2007, so if they keep capturing it over the years, that will be really good to grab.
Remember the ethical consideration of do no harm. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Go ahead, ma'am.
I had a question for Maureen.
Yeah.
I recognize a lot of the people you're talking about, but I wondered if you had any suggestions for me as a manager supervisor about how to deal, any resources about how to deal with some of these issues.
Not in terms of the specifics. I'm still in the process of really taking a look at the policies and procedures that are going to be useful. And it's by specific issue. If I'm understanding your question, you're like, okay, how do I deal with that coworker that storms into my office? That I don't have an answer to.
Well, I'm not even necessarily talking about on the individual level, but I work at a university of continuing education, and we have all soft money, and there's a lot of angst around funding cuts and things like that, and I see the kind of behavior you're describing, and trying to figure out how to set an atmosphere where, you know, people feel somewhat comfortable, but I can't give them complete comfort because
you can't do that. No, right. And we face the same thing where I am. I'm in the state of Illinois, and the state of Illinois is in the worst condition of all. it's really bad. And I think it would go back to, my initial comment would be to go back to that in tune, that emotionally in tune leader, that at least that, you know, your concerns are valid, and we're working to, you know, and this is just my own gut reaction to this. I don't have any data that would back up that as one of the appropriate ways to manage.
That's true.
Any other questions? Go ahead, sir.
My question about the privileging and credentialing that the Bureau of Health Professions provides support for. I'm just wondering if in LA County I've set up a process to privilege and credential my physicians there, but I think in general most public health agencies just do HR processes to look at privileging or credentialing. They don't really do more than that. And as the FAB rolls out and agencies are accredited and they're looking at WEA about workforce confidence, is there any activity between your office and the FAB to try to define best practices and how to credential and privilege stay out in public health agencies?
We actually don't work with agencies in terms of suggesting best practices, methods of best practices. Our role is basically to provide information about practitioners who have reports filed on them, and then have the agencies make that decision. Basically, our reports is used as a flagging system, which is only a component of the entire repertoire of variables that are accounted for when evaluating a practitioner.
You know, then, in that Health Care Quality Improvement Act of 1986, who was delegated that responsibility, because that was one of the two
goals.
You mentioned the 1986 Health Care Quality Improvement Act, and the first goal was to promote peer review activities.
Yeah.
So was that delegated to a specific federal agency?
Yes, Part B. As Part B, which indicates that information is to be reported, and that was the basis for establishing the NPDB.
Go ahead, sir.
My question is for Janet, or maybe Ron, I'm not sure. You talked about assessment of competencies, and your slide talked about it had a self-assessment on there, and then you mentioned something about an aggregate assessment. Mm-hmm. Is it any more than just asking, I am competent in these areas?
Yeah, that's all it is.
I mean, that's a challenge for all of us with competency-based programs.
Right.
Is how do you actually have folks, if you're a training program,
right,
demonstrate that they're competent?
Right, and that's why.
They're outside of a university.
Exactly. What I want to add to that.
If I may, John, the folks in the University of Wisconsin working with the Wisconsin Department of Public Health, they're developing what's called a scenario-based assessment. And they started with the cultural competency domain. And rather than asking, are you competent in X, Y, or Z, it takes you through a scenario.
Yeah.
And based upon your responses, it leads you to, well, you might benefit from additional training in X, Y, and Z. The problem, however, is it's incredibly complicated. They've been working on this for a couple of years. Anybody from Wisconsin? Okay. And they rolled out, we saw a demonstration of it about a year ago. But I think they're moving in that direction. So there's also the 360, which is asking the supervisor as well as the peers how they're observing confidence. And that's why we're also trying to come up with a tool on how to measure. How do you know one when you see one?
You know, we're doing that with our fellowship programs and developing a portfolio of evidence and trying to come up with the rubrics for measuring those and having to get people to supervise trainees to do that. But it's not easy.
No, it's not. That's why I said it.
I hope you had some magic.
No, that's what I said. We need your help. Why we said when we tried to develop outcome indicators for each of those, it was such an overwhelming, you know, prospect that, you know, we get in the state of, we'll just say, like, paralyzed.
Yes.
We stress out.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other question? Go ahead.
I guess half the people in the room know the answer to this question. The tiers are for a level of training? So.
Well, it's entry-level, management, and leadership.
Okay.
And also what's different is that whereas the 2001 competencies, they were just tier two, and defined as someone with an MPH. We've removed the academic part of it now because we know there are many people in leadership, manager roles, MBAs, MPAs, so that's, we're trying to make it much more.
Okay, and the idea is that the leadership person is maybe not competent in everything, but needs to be aware.
No,
his agency needs to be the leader can't be possibly have all the competence.
Right, well, if you look at it across, I mean, that's the thing, the original had kind of, you know, awareness, knowledgeable, proficient. But again, it ran into the problem of, you know, in certain areas, somebody in a tier one type of job wouldn't be allowed to do it, so
right.
We shouldn't even be bringing it up. But if when you read across the continuum, I mean, you can see, you know, that only tier one is they follow a procedure.
I get it for tier one, but for like the commissioner.
Yeah.
The commissioner is not going to be confident in everything, but he needs to make sure
right.
he knows where he's not confident in the
right. And that's true. That's going to be true of every discipline. You know, that a health educator, for example, is going to be, their focus is really going to be more on the community dimensions of practice and cultural competency. You know, somebody who's in, you know, EPI is going to be the assessment. And you're going to have, and a health director commissioner would be more of the policy, you know, and a leadership and systems thing. So it's as you move through your career, you have different weighting of those skills.
The competencies are not technical in nature either.
Right,
so
exactly.
She may be heading toward MD, I think. She may be heading toward a clinical skill of some sort.
Well, no, I'm from New Jersey, so I've seen the draft competencies for health officers
yeah.
in New Jersey. And you couldn't possibly, one human could not have.
Oh, I know. And
what I would consider competent, so maybe you're right.
In fact, I did that in North Carolina. We interviewed as many health directors as we could. We had 85 health directors. And they asked, you know, what do you think are the most important areas that you have to have? Of course, number one was political skills. And so we're able to do a prioritization of what we thought, rather than looking, because there's also, you know, the public health leadership competencies. And so I kind of crosswalked and, you know, and then just kind of came up with a set that was North Carolina focused. But when people looked at it, they went, this is true everywhere.
Okay.
So, you know, you just kind of have to.
Do you have any other questions? Colin, let me ask you a question. The data you presented, are those duplicated counts or unduplicated counts?
I'm sorry.
The data that you presented, are they duplicated counts or they are unduplicated counts?
In terms of
the report, because there's possibility that a physician might have a license to practice in two or three. Jurisdictions,
yeah.
So if he's bound to practice in Georgia, that doesn't mean he cannot go to North Carolina and practice in North Carolina, or go to Kansas and practice in Kansas. I mean, how is it set up? What is the
that is an unduplicated count?
Yeah,
so
it's unduplicated.
For each practitioner, I mean, because oftentimes the state that they're licensed in is different from the state that they're actually practicing in. So we do have variables indicating the state that they're licensed in, their home state, and their state of work.
Huh. Well, some individuals, for example, if I live in Houston, Texas. But I live in Beaumont, Texas.
Yeah.
I can practice in Texas, but at the same time I can practice in Louisiana because they're close to each other. How is that set up? I mean, I can be bound to practice in Texas. Does that mean I won't be able to? I mean, I can just pack my stuff and go to Louisiana and practice in Louisiana. Then I mean, you won't have a record of me practicing in Louisiana, right? Oh, hi. I just want to understand. I mean, how this or the implications for people that that do practice public health?
Is that the entity that files a report on the practitioner? That is where the information. So if the entity that files the practitioner has data indicating that that practitioner is licensed in Vermont,
uh-huh.
then that is the data that will be in our data bank.
So it doesn't take account of individuals with two or three. Licenses, right?
Actually, we do. We have multiple variables indicating the different licenses, like the first state of license, second, and so forth.
Oh, okay, I got you now.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah. So if Texas doesn't want for me to practice in Texas, I can go to Georgia. I just want to be clear. Any other questions? Thank you so much for your participation.